This is a section where I want to take a few minutes and introduce the whole idea of the times of the Gentiles. I have to bring this subject up at some point in the book of Daniel, and this is as good as any place. The times of the Gentiles are actually a period of time when Israel is under Gentile domination. And it starts in 605 BC. Now, some will say, well, it didn't start until 586 when the temple was destroyed. And if you listen to past things I've said or written, probably I would have said that at one point. But one of the things I want to do in this series of Daniel is take my time going through the text. So, yeah, we spent 3 Sundays on one chapter, chapter 2. But, you know, I want to take my time. It's been 20 years since I exegeted, translated Daniel. I might have taught it part-time previously back in the 90s, but I want to take my time on it. I think that when Daniel was hauled off by Nebuchadnezzar in 605 BC, that's the beginning of the times of the Gentiles. Israel is no longer a theocracy. Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, Zedekiah, they were puppet kings. They survived on the basis of their relationship to Babylon. If they have followed and obeyed the Nebuchadnezzar, things went well. If they didn't, they got hauled off to Babylon, and they had their kids slaughtered in front of them, and that sort of thing. So there is no longer a place where you can go and find God ruling over his people independently of a Gentile nation. So that is why we call it the times of the Gentiles. It continues all the way into the millennial kingdom. The times of the Gentiles actually end in Revelation 19 when Christ comes back from heaven. But Daniel's footprint goes into the first 75 days of the millennial reign, which is the length of time it takes to reformat planet Earth and establish, rebuild Jerusalem, change the topography, rearrange mountains, set up the nation of Israel, and the glorious kingdom of God begins. So the times of the Gentiles are where we are living. Okay, there's a specific timetable set by God, and we'll look at that when we get to Daniel chapter 9. But right now, I want us to see that what God does during this time of Daniel 2 is give us an overview of all of this time. So in verses 36 through 40 of Daniel chapter 2, we have an overview of the times of the Gentiles. Now, some of you may be saying, what are we talking about? Well, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and we studied online the dream proper. So if you want to go and see the exegesis of the dream, and as a result of my study in that section, I made changes that are going to be reflected in my explanation of the interpretation. But what's going on here is that Daniel is giving very specific technical information to King Nebuchadnezzar. And a lot of times we don't see the specifics, and I'm not sure I fully understand this. Nebuchadnezzar did, but down to a single head and then plural for the chest and plural for the hips and plural for the feet. And this is a terrifying image. And I, you know, possibly we have a wrong idea because everything we've ever seen in our children's Bibles is a long, tall statue of a person, which you look at that and say, oh, it's not terrifying. But Nebuchadnezzar was terrified on it. And he had a dream, and he had visions, and it was reoccurring. So Daniel, in his terminology, this is so cool. Daniel, in his terminology to Nebuchadnezzar, is very specific on what he saw. But I don't go over that today. I went over that online. So it's not a very long sermon. You get a shorter sermon if you listen online. See? Benefits all around. But here, he's going to give the interpretation. So in verse 36, which actually belongs to the previous section, this is the dream. So Daniel, in his very specific, detailed description of the dream and the visions that you had on your bed, You know, he's in Nebuchadnezzar's bedroom. He's in his mind. Daniel is there because God gave him the revelation. So as Daniel's talking, you can see the wheels turning in poor old Neb's brain. And his mouth drops open, and his mouth drops open, and his mouth drops open just on the dream itself. Now, here we come to the interpretation. The interpretation of it, we will tell before the king. It's plural, first person plural. We will tell. And my guess, the we is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego may have been with Daniel when he came before the king. Nothing in the text indicates that except for this plural we. It's also possible that Daniel is including his buddies because they were part of what God did in the night of Revelation. But it's a we. We will tell before you. And the Aramaic, as far as I know, does not have a polite plural like we do in English. Okay, it's not a polite of respectness. You, emphatic, you, king, are a king of kings to whom the God of heavens, see that, that's your name for the God of Israel, the God of heavens has given to you a kingdom and power and strength and glory, and God gave this to you. And wherever and in whatever dwelling place, wherever you find sons of humans, sons of men dwelling, and the beasts of the field and the winged creatures of the heavens, wherever that could be, he gave into your hand. So Nebuchadnezzar has a global kingdom. Interestingly, he never actually realized the global kingdom, but it was given to him. You'll have to pay attention here on these terms when he talks about the global aspects of the kingdoms. In some cases, it's listed as a global kingdom. Other times, it's not. But when you talk about Nebuchadnezzar and Rome, for instance, they're global kingdoms. Okay? So wherever it was, it's all under, you know, into his hand. And he caused you to rule over all of them. Even you are this head which is made of gold. In verse 39, and after you a kingdom will arise, another kingdom, and it's inferior from you. The inferior aspect, you say, well, you know, Babylon, it was smaller than Media-Persia. Media-Persia was a much larger kingdom. How is it, Kojo, pay attention, how is it inferior to Nebuchadnezzar? Well, the answer has to do, I think, in the nature of the king's rule. So when you come to Darius, for instance, and he pitches Daniel in the lion's den in Daniel 6, it's written according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians. Okay, so it's a rule of law. But with Nebuchadnezzar, man, he had no law but his own. His word was the law. That's one possibility, that it looks at the nature of the kind of king, the way the kings are ruled. But I'm not convinced that's the issue. Because as you get through Alexander the Great, man, he ruled just like Nebuchadnezzar. And you look at the final world ruler under Antichrist, there is no law but his. He's called the lawless one because he makes all the laws without regard. So I'm not happy with the kind of government that comes along, an explanation of why Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold. My guess is that Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold because he got converted. There isn't a better single world ruler that the world will ever see than Nebuchadnezzar, because God converted him, and we'll see that in Daniel chapter 4. That's my guess. But it's inferior, you know, but even I'm not comfortable with that, because I believe Cyrus was a believer, and he was the ruler of Persia. So I just don't know. Somehow in this coming of nations, It goes from the head of gold all the way down to a mismatch. We'll see. Anyway, it's inferior. And a third kingdom, another of bronze. We're not told that the second one is in silver. That's in the dream itself. And another, which is bronze, will rule over all the earth. Now here, the bronze, which is the Grecian Empire, it's a global kingdom. And a fourth kingdom will be strong like iron. This verse 40 is the conclusion of this summary. It will be strong like iron because, like iron, it's causing to be broken into pieces because it has this nature of itself and it crushes everything. And like iron, it pulverizes all of these. It crushes it and it breaks in pieces. Here he's describing the dream, which is part of the interpretation. So this final nation, it crushes, it pulverizes absolutely everything. Now in verses 41 through 43, the interpretation focuses an inordinate amount on the feet. The feet are separate from the legs. They're all of iron. The two legs are of iron. And personally, I believe that's the Eastern and Western division of the Roman Empire, divided into two parts, Rome and Constantinople. And then it comes down to the feet, where the toes, the 10 toes, are actually said to be kings. Okay, let's go through verses 41 through 43, where we see these feet. And what you saw, the feet, plural, and the toes, plural, the feet, you would expect a dual in Aramaic, and it's not. So whether these are 4 feet of the different, like the plural for the hips, and I don't know. The toes, from those, the clay of a potter, and from those, iron. So when he gets down to the feet and the toes, he says it's partly made of iron and it's partly made of clay, unlike the legs, which were just iron. The kingdom has been divided in its being of different quality. And from the hardness of iron, some of it shall be. And it just as to the times which you saw, iron being mixed with clay. And then there's a very specific term. It's unfired clay. It's wet clay. So I've had to change my thinking on this image. I had always, because of the English, thought we're looking at iron with clay infused on it, covering it over, and then it was fired in ceramic clay. That's not the term that he uses here. You have iron, which provides the rigidity, and then you have wet clay, wet potter's clay, that's smeared in, like if you were to take a honeycomb and then smear that sponge or honeycomb, which is rigid and hard, or like coral, and then you smear all of that smooth with clay. So you've got rigidity of iron, and then you have the looseness of the wet clay. Very specific in this image, which obviously Nebuchadnezzar saw over and over again. The kingdom will be strong in part of it, and part of it will be weak, fragile, weak, like wet clay. Difficult to translate the last word in the last verb in verse 42, but it could mean fragile, could mean broken, or my guess is that he's talking about it's pliable, like wet clay, which has no tensile strength as compared to iron. And as you saw iron having been joined together with wet clay, having been joined together, they will be in the descendants or seed or offspring of men. All right, I'm going to hope that somebody here, maybe Marvin or somebody, will take notes on this. At the end of this series, I'd like to have a compilation of all of the specific characteristics of the Antichrist. And here's your first one in the book of Daniel. The Antichrist is going to do something wonky with descendants. It's translated seed, but it means offspring or descendants or seed of humans. He's going to do something wonky with it. And again, I think what he's looking at here is the Antichrist is going to disrupt times and seasons. We'll see that later. But one of the things he's going to do to keep everybody on edge is mess with marriage, mess with who's marrying whom, and try to destroy a national identity and develop a global identity, similar to what we did in World War II in Africa. If you're familiar with what we did after World War II, the nations came together, all of Africa was a third world country, and they divided it up based on land grab and boundaries. They set boundaries based on not who lived there, but based on where was a good place to draw the line. So if you go to Burundi, that's a country in East Africa, there are 30 million people that speak Kirundi, but you'll find them in the Congo, Tanzania, Rwanda, and Burundi. They're in four different nations. They took that tribe and they split it, and they took part of another tribe and they split it, and they put two tribes together into one nation called Burundi. So you have the Hutus and the Tutsis. And the Hutus, they're rough and tough and hard to bluff and make the football players like the linebackers. You can look at them, that's a Hutu. And the Tutsis are tall and thin and they're smart. And the idea was that these people would intermarry and it would make a unified nation. And what resulted, even to this very day, is 20, 30 years of bloodshed and tribal warfare that continues on in a single nation. But the Antichrist, I think, is going to do this on a grand scale. Globally, he is going to mix up the seeds and offspring of men. Assyria did something similar to this, but Assyria was not in the times of the Gentiles. And no other nation in the times of the Gentiles, other than the Antichrist, is going to do this again. Assyria played hopscotch with peoples. They took 100,000 people, put hooks in their nose, marched them over there. This is your place. So that's how the Samaritans in Israel, that's where they came from. They were transplanted people. But it was a way of subjugation. This goes a step further in requiring, I believe, cohabitation to the end of intermarriage, intermingling, so that the distinction among the races is lost in order for him to maintain world control, world domination. But this is your first characteristic, and I'm not sure what it will actually look like. We'll have to add this to all of the others that Daniel gives us. And these will, the last part of verse 40, and these will be sticking that one with that one, just as iron does not join together with clay. So he's going to try to stick these together, but the problem is it isn't going to work. It's like trying to have a 10-day work week. Just does not compute to how God made us. In verses 44 through 45, we have the coming kingdom. In the days of these, look at verse 44. In the days of these, plural, kings. Now, who are the kings? I believe it's a reference to the 10 toes. So we'll get more information from Daniel 7 about how this is going to transpire. But there's 10 kings, and none of the 10 are the Antichrist. But in the days of these 10 kings who have a global kingdom, the God of heavens will establish a kingdom of which is forever. And it will not be destroyed. And the kingdom will not be left to another people. So when the kingdom of God comes, it's not going to have another successive kingdom. So you have these kingdoms starting with Babylon and Media-Persia and Greece and Rome and the revived Roman Empire, you know, the East and the West and the ten kings. At the end of that is where you're going to have God's kingdom coming, and this is it. For this planet, there will be no more rulers of men. And it shall break and crush and bring to an end all these other kingdoms, and the kingdom of God, understood, shall stand forever. And he's going to describe how this takes place in verses 46 through 49. But let me do 45 as we're continuing about this coming. And just as what you saw one time and another time and another time after that, that from the mountain a stone may be cut all by itself, which did not happen with hands. So this is God's kingdom. It's not a kingdom that comes from humans. It comes from a mountain. It comes of its own. It comes out by itself. And it crushed. Notice the order here. It's interesting that Daniel changes the order. It crushed the iron and the bronze and the clay and the silver and the gold. You know, why isn't that clay put up forward when it crushes the iron? But he flips clay and bronze. And I'm not sure why. Possibly the clay being a liquid, a squishy things that in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, he saw the feet being crushed and the clay squishing out up onto the bronze, and it gets ground like the bush or tripper shredder that they're going to be taking all the broken branches and throwing it in there, pulverizing. It hits it at its feet and it crushes it and grinds it down, and it comes down on itself as this stone totally destroys it, and the gold, the final head. The great God, interesting how the God who is greater than all the other gods, has made known to the king what will be after this. And I can see Daniel, you know, I think he folded his arms at this point, knowing he had scored an absolute home run. And he says, the dream is certain, and the interpretation, you can believe. So he nails it. Isn't that cool? So this coming kingdom is described. And then in verses 46 through 49, let's look at the king's response here. Then the king answered to Daniel, verse 47, saying, man, I can't believe it. From a truth, your God, he is the God of gods and the Lord of kings, a revealer of secrets, since you were able to reveal this secret. Verse 48. Then the king made great gifts, many great gifts, many great, great gifts for Daniel that he gave to them. And he caused him to rule over all the province of Babylon. He made him head or chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel asked from the king, and he appointed the administration of the province of Babylon. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Interesting that Daniel's set over everything, but he gets permission from the king to put his buddies over those positions. He doesn't do that. He had authority to do it himself, but he didn't do that. I think I skipped a verse. Did I skip a verse?
46,
yeah, because, oh, thank you. Someplace here in verse 46, and that at that point, then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face before Daniel and worshipped him. This is a pagan king, and did an offering to Daniel. A lot of confidence here in Daniel. He stands there, and he allows this pagan king to fall on the ground before him and worship him. He's a pagan. You get what you get with pagans. And he's worshiping Daniel like he's a god and making offerings to Daniel. And he commanded that incense be burned in worship of Daniel. The guy's a pagan. He doesn't get saved till chapter 4, so cut him some slack. But it's really interesting how Daniel is submissive to this pagan king. You know, here's what God is doing in this time of the Gentile. And then Daniel sat in the gate of the king. So here's what I want you to take away from this. From time to time, even pagans must acknowledge our God. We live in the times of the Gentiles, and we see in our own generation rulers, thankfully not in Texas, but rulers of our nation have no regard for the God who is over all gods, if they have regard for any God. The bishop just declared that Biden can't declare himself a devout Catholic. They have no regard for anything or anyone but themselves and their agenda. But from time to time, even pagans have to acknowledge there is a God of heaven. And what we need to realize that God is running his world on a very specific task. We are already in the East and West division of the Roman Empire. You go to France and they talk about Rome everywhere. I didn't know that. It's a Roman art festival. In their minds, it's still Rome, just called France. But this last Roman kingdom will be a global kingdom with 10 kings ruling over the world. And it's at that time and those kings, out of one of those structural arrangement of 10 kings, comes the Antichrist, and that's when the kingdom of God will come. Okay, let's take our hymn books and turn to number 96.